If you have any of these responses to conflict, defensiveness, rage, withdrawal, weepiness, whatever, it is certain that you developed them for a good reason. Once you understand how you learned your reflexes, more choices open up. Talk with your partners. What are their scripts? What's going on when A really wants to hear how B feels, only B is trying to get safe by hiding? Maybe you each have different skills you learned about dealing with conflict. Maybe you could learn new ones from each other. Fighting fair. Thinking about how intimate bonds are cemented by sharing vulnerable feelings brings us to perhaps the ultimate act of intimacy, fighting. Many people believe that fighting between partners is to be avoided at all costs, but most relationship therapists would disagree. Fights between partners appear to be a universal experience. Not many people actually enjoy them, but they seem to be necessary, a constructive element in the building of solid relationships, like the fires that make new growth possible in old forests. Only by fighting can partners struggle with their disagreements, express their most heartfelt feelings, and negotiate change and growth in their relationship. There has to be a way to communicate anger in a long-term relationship, and there has to be a way to struggle with disagreements. How many times have you had a bitter argument with your partner, and when it was over, felt closer than you had before? So the problem as we see it is not to avoid fighting, but to learn to fight in ways that are not destructive, physically, morally, or emotionally. A good fight is very different from abuse. In a good, clean fight, there is respect for safety and mutuality so that both people get to express their feelings at full volume and come out the other end stronger and closer than before, bonded by fire, as it were. The concept of fair fighting was first expounded by Dr. George R. Bach in his wonderful book, The Intimate Enemy, How to Fight Fair in Love and Marriage. Published in 1968, the book is terribly outdated, but the material on communication and the detailed descriptions of constructive ways to share your anger with a partner is priceless. This book is a classic. Reading a book together with your partner will put you both on the same page with some of the same information and get you talking about how you communicate about what's important to you, like how you feel. So, if feelings like to be heard, and anger is a feeling that can be very hard to hear, how can we vent anger without creating more trouble than we relieve?
Exercise, gibberish fight. This will be both silly and very satisfying. Set the timer for 2 minutes. Stand facing each other a little distance apart. Express your anger simultaneously with stance and gesture. Stamp your feet, wave your arms, and speak to your partner in entirely inarticulate sounds. Moans, groans, sighs, growls. If you're not sure what we mean here, imagine Donald Duck having a tantrum. It's hard to describe this in words, but when you go for the drama, freed from the need to make sentences or to figure out who's right and who's wrong, or even to make any sense at all, you'll communicate your feelings very well, and then have a good laugh. This is a great way to vent and break up the tension before a more serious conversation.
Triggering. How is it that we sometimes get triggered into very strong emotions, particularly at times of intimate conflict? We all do it. It's not just you. Dossie recalls at 19 having panic attacks that seemed to come out of nowhere, until one day she noticed that something had moved fast near her face. Her father was prone to sudden bursts of temper accompanied by a hard slap across the face, and Dossie realized that whenever something moved suddenly near her face, even her lover, some part of her believed that she was about to get hit. Once she understood this, she became able to look around and see that nothing was threatening her in the present, and these panic attacks disappeared. New research into brain functioning has given us a lot of very useful information about how triggering works on the physiological level. We have an organ called the amygdala in the middle of our brains, right under the hypothalamus, that does the job of remembering situations associated with strong emotions, both pleasurable and terrifying, and setting us into action. The most familiar form of this phenomenon is its greatest extreme, the flashbacks experienced by abuse survivors and combat veterans. The amygdala has a direct line to the pituitary gland and can set off our emergency response systems before our intellects can catch up. Adrenaline pours into our bloodstream, norepinephrine floods our synapses. Our cells release all their sugars into our veins to give us energy to fight or run. And everything instantly feels terribly, terribly urgent. Triggering is particularly common and intense in intimate arguments, where all of our old triggers we learned as children when we were truly helpless may get stimulated. The first thing to recognize is that nothing can get resolved in this adrenalized state. The flight-fight-freeze responses to adrenaline give us tremendous energy to survive a crisis, but not very much in the way of common sense. But all is not lost. Two things happen during this physiological stress response that we can learn to use. The first is that if we can occupy ourselves for 15 or 20 minutes without re-stimulating the stress reflex, our physiology will return to normal and we will return to sanity. The process of taking a time out to get calm again is described below. Better yet, every time we succeed in spending that 15 minutes taking care of ourselves in the kindest way we can muster, we actually physically heal our amygdalas by growing more fibers that deliver soothing neurotransmitters and thus increase our capacity to soothe ourselves in a crisis. So practice, practice, practice being kind to yourself. Here's how to take a time out when you and a partner get triggered. Find a way to stop and separate. Then find a kindly way to take care of yourself for about 15 minutes without re-triggering your emergency system until your adrenaline gets back to normal and you feel relatively calm. There are some agreements you will need to negotiate beforehand with each of your partners. First, everyone should understand that a timeout is absolutely not about whose fault this is. If what you're doing or talking about is what triggered the emergency overload, then both of you need to stop doing that in order to stop the adrenaline. Stopping can be difficult. Someone is almost certain to feel abandoned, cut off, interrupted, or unheard. Remember, this is for 15 minutes, not forever. Since you will probably need to be at least in separate rooms for a few minutes, a prior discussion as to what room each of you might want to be in is a good idea. Where are your computers, your books, your reading chairs? If someone likes to listen to music or watch television, are headphones needed to provide quiet for the other? If someone needs to go outside, it's useful to agree on a phone call within 20 minutes to check in and make sure everybody's all right. Some people like to agree on a safe word to call a timeout. Maybe timeout, or perhaps red, or maybe something silly that might help defuse the anger. If you laugh when you say pussycat when an argument has gotten out of control, maybe that's a good thing. If you have kids and they are home, who will be responsible for them? Children may get nervous or want reassurance when the adults fight, which is in no way wrong, but they might feel needy or clingy at a time when you'd rather be free to focus on your own needs. Make an agreement to honor a time out with silence. Trying to get in one more thought is likely to trigger another adrenaline release and prolong the problem. You'll want to talk these things over with your partner to plan your initial practice at time out. Then look for an occasion to practice. You might decide to call a time out over an issue that is only a little bit disturbing, just for practice. When you feel your most familiar uncomfortable emotions flaring up and you recognize you're being triggered, perhaps at the level of irritation or frustration, perhaps rage or grief, call a time out. Strong emotions often appear very fast and can be very hard to predict. So as soon as you remember the option when you start flooding with feelings, call a time out. Wrench yourself out of the conversation and go to your agreed-upon places. Do whatever you've thought might be calming and not re-triggering. Take a few deep breaths and remember to exhale thoroughly. Reducing carbon dioxide in your lungs will help the adrenaline subside. We like activities that occupy the mind. Neither of your authors has much luck with meditating when we're feeling triggered. If you can do it, go for it, but don't put yourself down if you can't empty your mind right now. We tend to turn toward a novel or a magazine, surfing the internet, solitaire, music, or maybe an old movie. Try to steer clear of things that create more adrenaline. Be careful of shoot-'em-up games or music with violent lyrics. Some people do very well with dancing out anger to raging hip-hop, while others find it too stimulating. You will learn from experience what works for you. You might want to write out your feelings or draw them. The quality of the art is irrelevant. This is for you. One of your authors has journal sessions that start with frankly insane projections, complete with terrible accusations, and gradually grow into a remarkably non-judgmental investigation of what she and her partner were fighting about, sometimes ending with new insights about what upset her so much. After 15 minutes, check in with yourself. Are you feeling better? Your timeouts could take longer the first few times until you learn what works for you and gain some confidence in your process. When you are ready to come back together, do something easy and comforting. Go for a walk in a park, or get your favorite takeout, or cook something together, or watch a video in a companionable way. Make an appointment to resume the discussion that triggered the timeout. The process of a timeout is seldom elegant, pretty, or even remotely resembling okay. We need to take timeouts when we are in emotional overwhelm and definitely not at our best. Be ready to forgive each other for being human. Be ready to forgive yourself. The results are well worth it when you come back together, ready for harmony and understanding. Win-win solutions. A good fight starts with the understanding that in order for a fight to be successful, both people have to win. If one person wins a fight and the other loses, the problem that caused the fight has not been resolved. It is naive to imagine that just because you've lost, you've given up your interest in whatever issue is at stake. When you feel overpowered, outgunned, or shouted down, you will be resentful, and the problem will go on being a problem. The only real way to win is to come to a solution where all parties concerned feel that they have won. So in a good, clean fight, each person's feelings get heard and considered, and solutions are decided on by agreement, not rhetorical might makes right. We make a fight fair by agreeing on rules and limits, and by respecting everyone's right to express their feelings and opinions, including our own. It is usually helpful to schedule a time to fight and make an agreement to do so. It does not promote constructive hostilities if we waylay our partner in the bathroom or on the way out the door to work. We need to schedule discussions at a time when we can give them our full attention. Scheduling fights has the added advantage that you can prepare for them, organize your thoughts, and know you have a time when this particular issue will be dealt with. If you feel bad about the grocery bills on Tuesday, and you know you have a date to fight about it on Thursday, it's pretty easy to put your stuff aside till then. Most people don't put their stuff aside very well when it seems that their issues will never get dealt with. What do you mean, schedule a fight? Don't they just erupt like volcanoes? And when we have a fight, we are not likely to obey any rules or respect any limits, right? Aren't we talking about intense emotional outbursts? Well, yes, we are. But we don't believe you can settle any issues when you are in an intense emotional state. When your feelings erupt, it is important to acknowledge them and pay attention. However awkwardly you may be expressing yourself, this is your truth. You obviously feel strongly about it, so it's an important truth. I messages. That's I as in you and I. Good communication begins with everybody talking about their feelings, long before they get to discussing the pros and cons of any solutions. Good communication is based on identifying our feelings, expressing them, and getting validation that our partner hears and understands what we are saying, whether or not they agree. Emotions are not opinions, they are facts, truths about what people are experiencing. Try speaking in sentences that begin with, I feel. There is an enormous difference between saying, you are making me feel so bad, and I feel so bad. The I message is a pure statement of feeling, and there is no accusation in it. When your lover doesn't feel attacked and doesn't need to feel defensive, he or she is free to listen to what you're actually saying. Conversely, if your sentence starts with you, and especially with you always, your partner may well perceive an attack and respond defensively. The words "I feel" then need to be followed with an emotion, sad, mad, glad, angry, or a physical feeling like queasy, tense, wound up, shaky. Messages that begin with "I feel that" more often express a belief than a feeling, as in, "I feel that we should not be enjoying so much sex," or a covert "you" message, like, "I feel that you are crazy." We are often tempted to describe our emotions in words that end in "ed," as in, "I feel judged, attacked, betrayed." This is a covert "you" message. You are judging, attacking, betraying me. Most of us resent it when another person tells us how we feel. Whether or not they are correct is immaterial. It is a violation of our boundaries when another person presumes to tell us what our inner truth is. Dossie trained with a supervising therapist who used to point his finger at clients and say, "I know what your problem is." You probably already know how you feel when someone does that to you. Try instead asking a respectful question. "How are you feeling right now? I'm wondering if you're sad." We can't ask our lovers to hold still while we sling accusations at them, using them as a target for our frustrations. That would be asking them to consent to being abused, and they would be right to resist. But we can ask them to listen to how we feel, because putting aside their own agendas for a few minutes and listening to our feelings is a doable task for the listener. To learn how to use "I" messages, try talking about an issue that is current for you without ever using the word "you," and without talking about what anyone else is doing, but only about your own feelings. This technique takes a little practice, but is less difficult than it may seem at first. When it's your turn to listen to how your lover feels, put yourself in listening mode. Remember, feelings like to be heard and validated, so don't analyze or try to explain things. Just listen. And you may be surprised to hear something you didn't know. You can learn how the world looks from someone else's shoes. You can appreciate that person's feelings. You can validate that person's position and expressed understanding. Then the solutions can flow more freely and more naturally. There are no wrong solutions and no right ones, only agreements that fit well with how we all feel.
Exercise. Feelings dyad. The purpose of this exercise is to speak about your own feelings in such a way that your partner can hear you and to listen carefully to your partner's feelings. Each person gets 3 minutes to speak while the other listens. Choose a time when you and your partner can spend half an hour or 45 minutes with no interruptions. Choose who will speak and who will listen. Set a timer for 3 minutes. 5 if you're feeling adventurous, but no more. Remember, feelings like to be heard. So while you are listening, all you're going to say are things that indicate listening, like, "Okay, yeah, I hear you, and I understand." Read about "I" messages earlier in this chapter. Remember that we can ask our beloveds to listen to us talk about our feelings and how we're doing. It's not fair to ask anyone to stand still and be a target for accusations and blame. So for this exercise, sentences beginning with "you" are out of bounds. Both of you should try to maintain eye contact during this exercise. Try this as a script to talk about jealousy, and you can later use it to discuss any emotional situations. Here's a script you can follow. Listener: about jealousy, what would you like to tell me? Speaker: when I look inside, I find... Speaking as long as is comfortable. Listener: throughout: yeah, I hear you. Okay, uh-huh. And so on. Listener: when speaker stops: is there anything else you'd like to tell me about that? Speaker may continue or say, no, I'm through for now. Listener: thank you. Listeners will often find themselves full of ideas, suggestions, and so on, which they need to keep to themselves. Put your own ideas aside for these few minutes and pay attention to what it's like to just focus on listening. Because you may be full of responses to what you've heard, we suggest waiting a bit or doing something else before switching roles. These are intimate conversations, Show your appreciation to your partner for being brave enough to talk about these struggles. Hugs work great.
Help is available. You don't have to do all this on your own. Many wonderful books, classes, workshops, and other resources are available. It's a good idea to put aside some time and energy to learn about communication and to do it with the person you're trying to communicate with. There are many excellent weekend workshops focusing on communication for couples. Many churches offer weekend marriage retreats, and some medical centers offer classes in couples communication and anger management. Workshops and classes are worth attending, even if they don't specifically address sluttery. We've never known a couple who went to a communication or intimacy workshop and didn't gain some good news skills and insights from it. Some workshops exist specifically to work on issues arising from non-monogamy. Don't hesitate to take these workshops and remember that the facilitator has expertise in creating safe environments to explore highly charged issues. Many couples repeat these workshops when a new issue has arisen in their lives. We encourage you to take a class or a workshop or to join a support group suitable to your needs. Just knowing that others struggle with some of the same issues that you do can help. Support, ideas, and information can also be found through online groups and tribes. A little more expensive but still excellent option is to do some sessions with a couples counselor. In general, we recommend this as a second-level alternative after you've already done some classes and workshops, unless you have privacy concerns that make classes and workshops difficult for you. Screen any of these resources about whether they'll be accepting of your open relationship. Some old-fashioned psychologists and the leaders of some workshops and retreats may believe that your lust for many people is a symptom of psychological disturbance. You may not feel adequately safe and supported in such a hostile environment. If you need help finding a sympathetic therapist or group, try asking your friends or search online for poly-friendly therapists. Most therapists now have websites where they list their skills and experience and something about their philosophy. You can email them to ask what their experience is in working with polyamorous relationships. We strongly recommend that you investigate these types of help sooner rather than later. Just about everyone can use an occasional communication skills tune-up, and if you wait until your relationship is in crisis, you'll face much harder work than if you'd been practicing your skills all along. Time is your friend. In some Native American cultures, it is customary to wait several minutes after a person speaks before responding. It is rude and disrespectful to fail to think about what the person has said. And to speak immediately would indicate that you have simply been waiting for the speaker to be quiet so that you can then attempt to change his or her mind. We recommend taking some time before responding to any serious communication, especially when it's important to the speaker. Maybe if you pay attention, you'll hear something new. People often approach a disagreement as if it were urgent that it be resolved right away. They strive for a resolution within minutes of discovering that they don't agree about something, something that they have, in fact, never agreed on. But you've probably been living with that disagreement for a long time, and a little more is not going to make a lot of difference. Thus, consider this strategy. Acknowledge the disagreement. Give each of you a chance to state your feelings using the principles you've learned in this chapter, and then take 2 days to digest what you've learned. When you return to discuss the disagreement, you will probably be in a much calmer mode. You may have a clearer understanding of what is important to you and an appreciation of what is important to your beloved and why. Thus, you may find yourself in a much better state to negotiate a solution that might make everyone happy. Dossie sees this phenomenon all the time in her therapy practice. When she sends clients home from a session in a state of disagreement that seems intolerable, she instructs them to hold this new knowledge for a couple days and see how they feel. Often they come back the next week reporting that it became easy to find a solution. So sometimes it will be most fruitful to wait 2 days before going on to consider solutions you might want to try, as in the 8 steps to win-win conflict resolution in the following chapter. Or after 2 days, maybe it will have become so easy that you won't need a special script to come to an agreement. Remember, where emotions are concerned, time is your friend. Writing it out. Sometimes our feelings are so complicated that it seems impossible to deal with them in face-to-face conversation with our beloved. Under such circumstances, you may want to write a thoughtful letter, either snail mail or email, to let your honey know the entirety of your concerns in a measured way that can be absorbed and processed at the recipient's own pace. This correspondence isn't a substitute for actual conversation, but it can be a good precursor to it, a way to open up the discussion that may feel a bit safer to start. It is vital, however, that you send this letter only after you've had time to think about it. The downside to correspondence is that it can't convey all the fine points of communication, facial expression, body language, touch. The upside is, or should be, that a letter can be composed carefully, without undue emotional overload. If you click send or drop the envelope into the mailbox before you've had a chance to think about its contents, you're taking on all the downside without any of the upside. Try writing a letter you're not going to send, expressing all your feelings and concerns. Janet keeps letters like this in the drafts folder of her email program. Dossie writes them in her word processor, which doesn't have a send button, and paste them into an email later. Write out all your feelings, and then close the file and go do something else. Come back and add stuff, or edit things out, for a couple of days. Then check what you've written, making sure you're owning your own stuff and using iMessages. We usually delete sentences that begin with the words, "You shithead." Later, when you can read the message and imagine your friend truly understanding whatever you are disturbed about, it's time to send it. We hope we do not have to remind you that your blog, or your social network sites, or your private email list of a few dozen very intimate friends is not the place to rehearse this private correspondence. Struggle with it yourself. Or, if that seems impossible, perhaps you can run it past one trusted friend, someone who would be acceptable to your lover too, to make sure you're saying what you're trying to say. Dossie wrote such a letter recently to a lover of hers. She wrote the first draft at a time when she was terribly upset, on a Friday. She was busy over the weekend but managed to revisit her letter from time to time. By Monday, the issues were still there, but after some processing seemed more manageable, so she called her friend on the phone and they talked, and resolved the issues quite easily and peacefully. The letter never got sent. Owning what's yours. When you are willing to own your distress, it becomes possible for your lover to comfort you, to offer you reassurance and love when things are hard. Even when you don't agree about how you are going to handle an issue, you can still exchange love and comfort. We recommend that everyone be open about asking for reassurance, love, hugs, comfort, and stuff like that. Many of us grew up in families where we were taught not to ask for what we needed and were scorned, perhaps, as only wanting attention. So what's wrong with wanting attention? Isn't there plenty? Remember about starvation economies. Don't shortchange yourself. You do not have to be content with little dribs and drabs of comfort, attention, support, reassurance, and love. You get to have all the comfort and reassurance you want. You and your intimates can set yourselves up to share lots and lots and lots, and in the process learn how much more you have to share than you ever thought. So focus on abundance and create a relationship ecology rich in the good things of life, warmth and affection and sex and love. Chapter 15, Making Agreements. Most successful relationships, from casual acquaintanceship through lifetime monogamy, are based on assumptions that are really unstated agreements about behavior. You don't kiss your mailman. You don't tip your mother. These are the unspoken rules we learn very early in our lives, from our parents, our playmates, and our cultures. People who break these unspoken rules are often considered odd, sometimes even crazy, because the values and judgments behind the social agreements about how we relate to one another are so deeply ingrained that we are usually not even aware that we have made any agreement at all. In many day-to-day relationships, like your relationships with neighbors and coworkers, it's probably fine to rely on those implicit built-in agreements. But when you're trying something as complicated and unprecedented as ethical sluthood, we think it's very important to take nothing for granted. Talk with the people in your life about your agreements and negotiate the conditions, environments, and behaviors that will get your own needs met and respect everybody's boundaries. You'll often hear people talking about the rules of their relationships, but rules implies a certain rigidity, that there is a right way and a wrong way to run your relationship, and that there will be penalties if you do it wrong. We understand that there are many different ways that people may choose to relate to each other, so we prefer to use the word agreements to describe mutually agreed upon conscious decisions designed to be flexible enough to accommodate individuality, growth, and change. These agreements are sometimes a little fuzzy, particularly if you're used to the hard edges of rules. A little fuzziness is okay. Your agreement will either get clarified later if it needs to be, or it won't, in which case it's probably clear enough. How do you know when you need an agreement? You can tell by listening to your emotions. If something comes up that leaves you feeling upset or angry or unheard or whatever, that's an area in which you and your sweetie may need to discuss making an agreement. We suggest that you let go right now of the idea that you can predict every single situation that might come up in your relationship and make a rule to cover it. Just forget it. Many perfectly good agreements got made by 20/20 hindsight. A problem comes up, and instead of arguing over whose fault it was, the people simply make an agreement to try to prevent that problem from coming up again, or to deal with it when it does. Our friends Lori and Chris have become extraordinarily flexible agreement makers through practicing a lot. They speak.
We met at the Renaissance Fair and made a pretty deep connection right away. Although we didn't feel ready to jump into marriage right off, we did get handfasted, an ancient Celtic rite of romantic commitment, about 5 months after we met. Our handfasting included an agreement that if we still wanted to be together a year and a day later, we'd get married. And we did. When we first decided to get handfasted, Chris proposed an agreement in which we'd be free to be sexual with other people during fair, but at no other time. Lori felt shocked by his desire to do this and insecure about what might happen. So we decided to postpone a decision until the next summer's fair, after we'd gotten married. During the first year of our marriage, the agreement was for fair only. And then, after that, we extended it to the weekend preparatory workshops, as well as to fair itself. At one of these, Lori met a guy with whom she got fairly seriously involved. It was our first ongoing relationship outside the marriage. At that point, things opened up all the way to where Lori was spending a lot of her time with her other lover. And Chris didn't like it much. He felt that he wasn't getting enough time with Lori. So, we renegotiated. We decided that either of us could sleep over with another partner twice a month. We felt that twice a month was often enough for fun, but not so often as to encourage a threateningly strong bond with someone else. That's been working pretty well for a while, although we've compromised on a case-by-case basis a time or two. We're still working out the bugs. Among other things, we're hoping to become parents pretty soon, and we're not sure how a baby will affect our relationship. But our agreements have always been at least tolerable, and at times they've offered a relief valve that's kept us from fleeing the relationship in terror.
Chris and Lori have had 2 children in the 11 years since this interview and are still together and still happily slutty. Consent. So what constitutes a good agreement? In our opinion, the single most important hallmark of agreement is consent, which we define as an active collaboration for the pleasure and well-being of all concerned. In the case of polyamory, this consent often includes that of people not directly involved. other partners, children, and other people whose lives are affected by our agreements. Defining consent can sometimes be tricky. If someone consents under pressure, we don't think that meets the active collaboration criterion. And you can't consent to something you don't know about. Well, you didn't say I couldn't fly to Boise for 2 weeks with this flight attendant I just met. Does not constitute consent. In order to achieve this kind of active consent, it is critical that everyone involved accept responsibility for knowing their own feelings and communicating them. But this isn't always easy. Sometimes feelings don't want to be pulled to the surface and examined. You may simply know that you feel bad. Give yourself the time and support you need to get to know that feeling. Perhaps using some of the strategies we discuss in Chapter 13, Roadmaps Through Jealousy. If you feel that you need help in defining what's going on for you, it's okay to ask for that help, possibly by asking a partner or a more neutral friend who understands multiple relationships to devote some time to hearing you out. Physical or verbal reassurance often makes a huge difference, and sometimes a wise friend or therapist can ask the right question to help you untangle a complicated feeling. Once you start listening to your own feelings, you'll have a much easier time getting your needs and desires out there where everybody can hear them and make agreements to help meet them. Most of us need some support in asking for what we want. When we are involved in making agreements, we need to feel sure that the needs we reveal will not be held against us. Most of us feel pretty vulnerable in and around our emotional limits, so it's important to recognize that these limits are valid. I need to feel loved. I need to feel that I'm important to you. I need to know that you find me attractive. I need you to listen and care about me when I feel hurt. Blaming, manipulation, bullying, and moral condemnation do not belong in the agreement-making process. The process of making a good agreement must include a commitment from all concerned to listen to one another's concerns and feelings in an open-minded and unprejudiced way. If you are waiting for your partner to reveal a weakness so that you can exploit it into ammunition to win your argument, you are not ready to make a satisfactory agreement. Legalistic hair-splitting is another enemy of good agreements. We know one couple whose agreement was that either of them would let the other one know within 24 hours if they were going to have sex with someone else. One of them called the other one from another city to let her know that he'd had sex with someone else the night before. "But you said you'd give me 24 hours notice," she cried angrily. "I never said 24 hours before," he pointed out. This loophole-finding legalistic behavior left neither individual feeling that their agreement had worked for them. The moral? Be clear, be specific, and above all, negotiate in good faith. This is not about cheating anymore. Agreements need to be realistic and clearly defined. If you're not sure whether you're keeping an agreement, it may be time to redefine that agreement. It is unrealistic, for example, to ask your partners never to enter into sexual interactions with people that they care about too much. There is no way to define too much, and few of us conceive of our polyamorous utopia as a world in which you are only allowed to share sex with people you don't care about at all. None of us can truthfully agree to feel only this way or that way. Our agreements need to have room in them for real emotions, whatever they may be. A more concrete agreement would be to limit outside dates to once a month, which might serve the same purpose. Agreements do not have to be equal. People are different and unique, and what pushes my buttons might be perfectly okay with you. So one person might find it very important that his partner not stay out overnight, where a said partner might actually enjoy an occasional opportunity to watch the late movie all alone and eat crackers in bed. One friend of ours says, "Bill and I have very different needs when it comes to relationships. I feel no need to be monogamous. I'm quite comfortable having sex with people I like, but they're not affairs of the heart. Whereas his sexual connections are either very casual, like at parties, or very deep and long-term. We've formed agreements that meet both of our needs, mine for friendly partners and fuck buddies, his for long-term secondary relationships." Fairness does not mean perfectly equal. Fairness means we care about how each person feels and make agreements to help all of us feel as good as possible. When thinking about agreements for an open relationship, most people start out by listing what their partner should not do. Don't kiss her on the mouth. Don't treat him better than you do me. Some thou shalt nots are necessary. Agreements need to be made, for example, about sexual connections with relatives, neighbors, and coworkers. But many negative agreements are really about protecting your partner from feeling hurt or jealous. And we're not big fans of these, although we recognize that they sometimes have their place as an intermediate step. We think that the best agreements to protect your partner from emotional pain are positive. Let's have a special date next weekend. I will find time to listen to you when you hurt. I'll tell you how much I love you again and again. Everyone needs a sense of emotional safety to succeed at feeling secure in open relationships. But thinking up agreements that will help both partners feel emotionally safe can be confusing. In the process of unlearning jealousy, we will all at some time be asking our partners to take some risk, to agree to feel some painful feelings, to fall down a few times in order to learn how to ride the emotional bicycle of truly free love.
Exercise: 8 steps to win-win conflict resolution. 1. Take time out to ventilate anger. 2. Select one issue to work on. 3. Make an appointment to talk. 4. Each person takes 3 minutes to state how they feel while their partner listens. Hint: use I statements, avoid you messages, and consider allowing time between each person's statement. Try as hard as you can to describe your emotions about the issue. 5. Brainstorm. Write a list of all possible solutions, even silly ones. 6. Edit the list. Cross out any suggestions that either person feels they could not live with. 7. Choose a solution to try for a specific period of time, perhaps 2 to 4 weeks. 8. Reevaluate when that time is up.
One way you can make agreements to respect emotional limits is to ask for whatever might make you feel a little bit safer. Reassurance, compliments, affection, a special ritual for homecoming after a date. And then when that works and you feel a little safer, take another step toward even more safety. And soon you will feel safe enough to expand your explorations further and further. Each tiny step in the direction of freedom will eventually get you there. One of the things that works about reassurance is that once we understand that our partner or partners, or maybe even also their partners, are willing to help us with our feelings, we feel more secure and need less and less protection as we go along. The single most important thing to remember about agreement making is that the purpose of an agreement is to find a way in which everybody can win. Some agreements. We've done some asking around among our friends and colleagues to find out what kinds of relationship agreements have worked for others. Here's a partial list of agreements we've heard from some very successful sluts. Notice as you read it how many different kinds of agreements it contains. Some are sexual, some are relationship-oriented, some thou shalts and some thou shalt nots, some logistical and some sentimental. Just so you know that we're not recommending any of these, you should also note that some are mutually exclusive. We're presenting this list as a discussion opener, not as how it ought to be. Everybody has to make some agreements about sexual health and safer sex. We always use condoms and barriers for all possible fluid exchanges. We always spend the night together except when one of us is traveling. I'll watch everyone's kids this weekend. You do it next weekend. Neither of us will fill in specific sexual act with other partners. Either of us can veto the other's potential other partners. We always provide advance notice of potential other partners. Don't tell me about other partners. Tell me everything you did with other partners. Other partners must be same sex / opposite sex. We always meet each other's partners, no strangers. Outside sex will only be group sex or party sex or anonymous sex or committed sex... We must check in with each other to confirm safety after a get-together with a new partner. Everybody chips in for the babysitter. We see others on Friday nights only. Saturday nights are for us. Be sure to save some hot sexual energy for me. Sex with other partners is off the limit in our bed or our house. We set limits on phone calls, internet time, etc. with other partners. We establish quality time with each other. We establish agreements about who can talk about what to whom. Don't take off the ring I gave you. Little gifts and cards help me feel less abandoned. Who is too close to have sex with? Neighbors, schoolmates, coworkers, close friends, former lovers, your doctor, your lawyer, your partner's therapist, your siblings? We'll spend an hour cuddling and reconnecting afterward. Predictability. Our experience is that we need some kind of predictability to deal with the stresses of open relationships. Most people can handle a nervous-making situation much better if they know when it is going to happen and when it is going to be over. You can plan to do something supportive with a friend, go to a movie, visit mom, whatever, and tell yourself that you only have to handle things for this chunk of time, and then your sweetie will come back and maybe you can plan a celebratory reunion. Most people have a hard time dealing with surprises, which can feel like landmines exploding. Very few of us would be comfortable living with the possibility that our partner might go home with someone else at any time, from any party we go to, from the restaurant where we thought we were just going for a cup of coffee. No place, no time would be secure. One partner of our acquaintance was working across the country from his spouse during a time when he was first struggling to deal with his jealousy. He made an agreement to know when his partner was playing with someone else because, as he put it, if I know when she is out with someone else, I also know when she isn't, and then I can relax most of the time. If you feel that planning takes too much of the spontaneity out of your life, then think about declaring one night or one weekend a month to be open season. Then you can make a decision whether to join your partner in cruising or sit this one out in a quieter milieu. An agreement to be unpredictable at some specified time is, after all, predictable. When there is no agreement. There are probably a lot of things in your life on which you feel no need to reach agreement. Everyone deals with differences in relationships all the time, as any night person married to a morning person can tell you. However, lack of agreement can feel less comfortable in the close-to-the-bone field of sexual relationships. When feelings run high, particularly about sexual issues, it's easy to want to believe that your way is right and that all other ways are wrong. One way to avoid the trap of turning a difference into a moral argument is to look carefully at ownership. Who owns what in this disagreement anyway? What is A's investment in this particular choice? How is B feeling different about it? And what are we afraid might happen if we can't agree? Try to get really clear on how each person feels before you even think about what you want to do about this issue at hand. Understanding your own and your partner's emotions will lead to new and better ideas for agreements or resolution. It can help to remember that you have been living with differences and disagreements with everyone in your life ever since you met them. When you discover a sexual difference with one person, it has probably been there all along, and yet you still like each other and share a lot of good stuff. Remember that you've been getting along fine without this particular agreement. If you've made it this far, you can live with the lack of agreement a little longer. Let time be your friend, and when difference is difficult, allow yourself the time to thoroughly explore the feelings that are driving the disagreement and arrange to lead a rewarding life while you do it. You really can agree to disagree. Between the yes of full agreement and the no of full disagreement is a whole big gray area of no agreement yet, or tolerable disagreement, or even who cares. Sometimes you will eventually find it possible to make an agreement, and other times you won't. Occasionally, however, you will hit an area in which agreement is both necessary and impossible. For many people, the whole issue of non-monogamy may be one of these. Childbearing is another frequent point of contention. We suggest flexibility and compromise-seeking, possibly with the help of a qualified therapist. But if agreement simply cannot be reached, we think the skills you learned in trying to reach agreement can come in very handy as you practice not blaming, not judging, and not manipulating as you work to change or even end a relationship that cannot reconcile its differences. Some people agree to end a relationship and then discover that later on, when the stress of parting has eased, they can agree on a new kind of relationship with the same person. Others cannot. But either way, forthright and open-hearted discussion of disagreements and agreements will lead to a cleaner and less stressful outcome. Making space for difference. You and your sweetie might have different visions about what polyamory will be for you. For one person, it could be a lot of recreational sex, one-night stands, or party play. Another might yearn for one primary and one special secondary relationship. Some people enjoy many relationships that make extended families out of their lovers and their lovers' lovers. Others look for a 3- or 4-person group marriage. Negotiating difference, however, can be done and is being done successfully every day. So what if one person wants SM or Tantra or wild orgies and the other wants walks on the beach at sunset? Once you've opened your relationship to other people who may be more accepting of those desires, anything is possible. Dossie has worked with a number of couples with these kinds of differences. Agreements may be asymmetrical to account for different desires and different feelings, and each individual may need a different kind of reassurance. The relationship lover may feel shy and unhip. The party animal may feel judged or threatened by long-term partners, and each needs to have their own feelings validated and cared for. Reaching agreement. So how do you find an agreement that will work for everyone? A good place to start is by defining your goals. A goal is not the same as an agreement. Your goal is what you're trying to accomplish, and your agreement is the means you're using to try to get there. For example, if your goal is to prevent anyone from feeling taken advantage of, your agreement might be to ensure that nobody's personal space, time, or belongings are being infringed on. So start with getting clear on what feels like infringement to each person involved, and use that for your guidelines. Often you will discover a goal by tripping over a problem. Last night when you and Sam were in our bedroom together, my feet were freezing and I couldn't get in there to get my bedroom slippers. The goal is to prevent this problem from coming up again. What kinds of agreements might help achieve that goal? Answering these questions will require an honest and often difficult look at what the real problem is. Is it that your feet are cold? Or that you resent being kicked out of your own bedroom, or that you're feeling threatened and left out. Once you've defined your problem and your goal, it's time to start figuring out a good agreement. It might be appropriate to do a trial agreement to put a time limitation, a weekend, a week, a month, a year, on your newborn agreement to see how it feels to everybody concerned. After the time is up, you can sit down again to discuss what worked, what didn't, and whether to continue your agreement or revise it or scrap it. In our experience, it's rare for an agreement to last a lifetime without change. Human beings change, and so do agreements. The way you can tell that your agreement needs to change is when someone doesn't agree to it anymore. Janet and one of her partners, for example, began their relationship with an agreement that they could be sexual with other people, but they couldn't fall in love with anyone else. Then one of them did. In hindsight, this seems like a fairly silly agreement, as though you could simply decide not to fall in love. She remembers,
"There was a period in which we were having check-ins 1 or 2 times a day. This was a situation neither of us had ever planned on. We found it was very important to stay in the moment and to stay with tangible things. Yes, it feels okay if she sleeps over while I'm out of town. No, it doesn't feel right for you to bring the two of us to the same party. We found during that experience, as well as similar ones that came later, that the words, in love with, made us both feel kind of panicky. that agreements that dwelt on measurable factors, such as time, behavior, and space, worked better for us.
Expect to try out some agreements and find out that they don't work, and expect to need to change them. You will get better at this process with practice, and in time you may know your own and your partner's needs so well that negotiating agreements will be easy. But in the beginning, while you are learning, tidiness won't count anywhere near as much as tolerance. When you first set out, some of these discussions may get quite heated. Remember, anger is an emotion that tells you what is important to you. What is constructive about these difficult times is what you learn about your partners and about yourself. Remember that there are many good ways to structure your sluttery. Structure is not what makes you safe from hard feelings. Your ability to take care of yourself is what counts. So whatever structure you choose, hold it fairly loosely. Your agreements are not taking care of you. You are. Don't get discouraged. All the successful sluts you see who seem so carefree have fought over their agreements. You too can work your way through this tangled web of assumptions and emotions and learn to love with openness and freedom. Chapter 16, Opening an Existing Relationship. Many people come to a time when they want to open their relationship to more sexual partners. But when your relationship was established under conventional monogamous agreements, you can't expect to proclaim open sesame and have everything fall magically into place. Like everything else about ethical sluthood, and perhaps even more than other ways of relating, opening an existing relationship requires care, thought, practice, and work. The relationship that you want to open may or may not be a life partnership. You may or may not be living together. You might have been practicing serial monogamy with the usual occasional overlap, or you may be dating and keeping all your lovers compartmentalized and want to move towards something more like a family or tribe. You may be looking for adventures outside of a triad or a group marriage. The work of opening is still work, no matter the nature of your relationship. For the sake of simplicity, we are going to talk about opening a relationship between an existing two-person couple. But the principles and skills we discuss here can apply to lovers in any configuration. Turning two into three. If you and your lover are beginning this work with equal agreement that you both want to create this expansiveness in your lives, then congratulations and welcome to the path. You will probably encounter some unexpected disagreements about the way this new life will look, so you still don't get to skip this chapter. In our experience, though, it's much more common that one person wants to open the door to outside connections and the other hasn't ever even considered it and is appalled by the idea. This situation is definitely more difficult, especially when the third member of the triangle, the outside partner, potential or actual, open or secret, is waiting in the wings and probably cares a lot about the outcome of this process. A lot of people don't really think about monogamy until they make a connection with someone who feels important to them, and they don't want to give up their beloved life partner or get a divorce or split up the kids. You could be in any of these roles in the triangle, the one with the lust for adventure, the new love who is not a partner, and the sometimes stunned partner to the would-be adventurer. In physics, the triangle is considered one of the most structurally sound and well-balanced structures. But in relationships, the very phrase love triangle carries a whiff of tabloid drama. This particular situation is not made any easier by the fact that it's been happening for as long as there have been relationships. It can help to remember that it is utterly normal to have differences in desire in any relationship. You don't need to both get excited about the same flavor of ice cream. Making room for everyone's desires can work for all concerned. We know many people who have done so, reaching accommodations that work for all three people involved. Let's look at the dilemma from all three points of view. The adventurous partner. The advantage of being in this position is that you know, more or less, what you want. Perhaps you bought this book for your spouse, hoping for some freedom down the road, and probably hoping that there is some way that you and your spouse can reach agreement without going through a whole lot of agony. However, you and your spouse are both